31. We're going to look tonight at Proverbs 31, verses 10 through 22. Who can find a virtuous wife? For her worth is far above rubies. The heart of her husband safely trusts her, so he will have no lack of gain. She does him good and not evil all the days of her life. She seeks wool and flax and willingly works with her hands. She is like the merchant ships. She brings her food from afar. She also rises while it is yet night and provides food for her household and a portion for her maidservants. She considers a field and buys it. From her profits she plants a vineyard. She girds herself with strength and strengthens her arms. She perceives that her merchandise is good, and her lamp does not go out by night. She stretches out her hands to the distaff, and her hand holds the spindle. She extends her hand to the poor. Yes, she reaches out her hands to the needy. She is not afraid of snow for her household, for all her household is clothed with scarlet. She makes tapestry for herself. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. As we come to this famous passage of Scripture, first thing I should probably ask this evening, before we even get into it, is what things surprise you about it as you read it or hear it read? Is there anything that particularly comes as a surprise to you, or is it so familiar that you know it's there and you know what it says and so on? Yeah, doing things other than just taking care of the household. And that is one of the surprising things about the passage. And we will deal with that tonight. Anything else?
Jackson.
Yes, brother.
I think in verse 10, I mean, if King Lemuel is Solomon, then he had 700 wives and 300 porcupines. And so he... To have him say an excellent wife who can find, I mean, he had 1,000 of them virtually, and yet he still wrote this. I find that very interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. We don't want to just push that and lean on it a great deal. but it is interesting, and of course, for those of you who have wives or had mothers who you could easily imagine in the context of this passage, then you know what it's talking about. It's talking about a woman who is noble, a woman who has a great deal of character. The interesting thing is the word virtuous itself. The New King James titles this section the virtuous wife. It is known as the virtuous woman. The original translation in the King James, with which we're all familiar, is who can find a virtuous woman. And it has also been called the wife of noble character. But the interesting thing is the term virtuous. If you want to see how language has evolved, you might consider that the word virtuous comes from the Latin word vir, V-I-R. Anybody happen to recall what that is? It's the Latin word for man. And so the term virtuous actually comes from the Latin word virtus, which means manly. Well, obviously...
Let's not press that one.
Let's not press that one either. Let's not press that one either. What has virtuous come to mean? We no longer think of it as manly, and that's not the connotation in our English versions. What does virtuous mean?
The American Standard says excellent.
Excellent. Yes, excellent. This is an interesting word because in English, of course, it does mean someone of noble character, someone who does good and is excellent. But the primary meaning of it is having to do with strength. So what you have here is the phrase, wife of strength. Who can find a wife of strength? Now, believe me, they look for them in New Guinea, literally, because the wives bear all the burdens. They're the ones that you load everything down on, and then you walk off and go hunting while your wife carries all the stuff. So they need a wife of literal physical strength. In Ruth 3:11, when Ruth comes to visit Boaz at night at the threshing floor, Boaz says to Ruth that she is known publicly as this very phrase, a woman of strength, an excellent woman, a virtuous woman. And the Hebrew word can mean valor, or it can mean activity, or it can even mean wealth. It's an interesting word because it can mean so many different things. Before I go into why all of those things are mixed up in the word and why it's a very appropriate word to be used here, I want to say a word to all women here. And that is that this passage describes attitudes and activities appropriate to a single woman as well as a wife. And furthermore, these attitudes and activities will be attractive to men and may in fact show desirability for marriage. And I base that simply on a biblical example, as well as all the practical examples that you can think of. The biblical example is when Abraham sent his servant back to the land of his fathers, to the land of Canaan, but to the land that God had showed him. He sent him back to Canaan to find a wife for his son Isaac. And when he went back to the city of Nahor and found Rebekah, do you remember that the servant prayed a prayer? He essentially laid out a fleece before the Lord. He said, "Lord, this is my requirement. Whoever does this, let her be the one that you've chosen." Do you remember what that requirement was? Yeah, in other words, the requirement was this. He said, "Now let it be that the young woman," and I must admit I do prefer the old King James version there, "the damsel. Let it be that the damsel to whom I say, please let down your pitcher that I may drink, and she says, drink and I will also give your camels a drink. Let her be the one you have appointed for your servant Isaac. And by this I will know that you have shown kindness to my master." Well, now the interesting thing is, he wasn't asking, was he, for a great beauty. And he wasn't asking just for someone who would show some kindness to a stranger. He was asking for one who would display an extra measure of generosity and hospitality. He was asking for someone whose character was such that she would reach out in sacrifice beyond herself. Because after all, what he was looking for was a woman with a pitcher. And she had to bear the burden not only of the empty pitcher to the well, but even furthermore, the full pitcher back. And one could well imagine that she would not want to be involved with any extra favors done with the water from the pitcher. But the servant said, when she came, "Please let me drink a little water from your pitcher." It says that a young woman came, and the young woman was very beautiful to behold, a virgin. And it says in verse 18 of Genesis 24, "So she said, drink, my lord. Then she quickly let her pitcher down to her hand and gave him a drink. And when she had finished giving him a drink, she said, I will draw water for your camels also until they have finished drinking. And she quickly emptied her pitcher into the trough, ran back to the well to draw water, and drew for all his camels. And the man, wondering at her, remained silent, so as to know whether the Lord had made his journey prosperous or not. Then when he begins to talk to her, do you remember that he not only finds out that she is in fact related to Abraham, but he also finds out that she is willing to open the home to him and his party. She says, we have both straw and feed enough and room to lodge. So what emerges is that you do in fact have a beautiful damsel, but you have a damsel who has the character of generosity and hospitality. And therefore, what I'm saying is that obviously this chapter applies to wives, but it also applies to all of you who are single young women as well. It applies to you teenagers who are going to be women soon. And this word, virtuous, talks about valor, a sense of bravery, talks about activity, talks about endurance, talks about wealth. It's a difficult word to translate. There's a lot implied in it. It is describing someone who has all the characteristics that we find in the verses. Someone noble and trustworthy and active and wise and good. And this woman is, very appropriately for this book, the embodiment of wisdom. And that's why the book ends as it does, because it has been the book about wisdom in the Bible. The subject that the whole book has been about is now given its ultimate application in these last verses. In other words, it's the ultimate application of the previous 30 chapters of Proverbs. So these verses are wisdom portrayed as a heroine in dealing with all sorts of situations. Now, perhaps very few ladies will ever be involved with all that this woman deals with, or have the status that she obviously has, or be as wealthy as she obviously is. But because she is all of these things that perhaps many of you will never be, the passage gives the model for a woman of many privileges and talents and responsibilities. And so it's a description to be aspired to, whether it's for a teenager on the threshold of womanhood, or whether it's a wealthy, multi-talented, business-minded wife of a prominent citizen and the mother of children. Most of you are somewhere between those two categories tonight. Back in the third chapter of Proverbs, verses 13 through 15, it says, happy is the man who finds wisdom and the man who gains understanding. For her proceeds are better than the profits of silver, and her gain than fine gold. She is more precious than rubies, and all the things you may desire cannot compare with her. And here we find that this woman is like wisdom. She also is a treasure. She is more precious than rubies. One of the most helpful things that any husband can ever do is to always be thinking of his wife as a treasure. Always a treasure. Always someone who has been given to him by God with characteristics and attributes that are suited to him. And that's where we want to go in verse 11, this suitability. Verse 11, the heart of her husband safely trusts her, so he will have no lack of gain. Do you remember that the first thing that God ever pronounced not good in the Garden of Eden was what? The loneliness of the man. He said it is not good for the man to be alone. And the answer to the problem was that the Lord said, I will make him a helpmeet for him. Now, originally in the King James Version, from whence we get help and meet were two different words. And we've come to call them one word, help meet, or to corrupt the word by saying help mate. But that is not originally what was said. What does the word meet mean in Elizabethan Bible English?
Fitting
or suitable, yes. In other words, it's what John the Baptist said when he said, bring ye therefore fruits meet for repentance, fitting for repentance. And so what happened was that God said, I will make him a helper that is fit for him, a helper that is suitable for him, a helper that is complementary to him. Now, most husbands simply want a complementary helper spelled C-O-M-P-L-I-M-E-N-T-A-R-Y. Whatever else you do, be complimentary to me. But I didn't say complimentary. I said complementary. Complimentary means that you complement one another. I've often told people that between Barbara and myself, we make up about one semi-competent human being. We are one flesh, and we are both made in the image of God. Male and female, He created them in the image of God, and we image God in the husband and wife relationship as the helper is taken into the life of the man and she is suitable for him. Now this woman that is being talked about in Proverbs 30 can be safely trusted by her husband. He can be safely trusted by her husband to do that which is best for him and for the family. It says, his heart safely trusts her. And it is because he is so well aware that she has his interests at heart. And one of the most important characteristics, I would say, of any wife is that a man can leave a matter in her hands, can leave affairs in her hands, can say, honey, will you please take care of this because I can't, or I'll be out of town or just unable to. And he can trust her to take care of that situation responsibly. This is one of the greatest blessings for any husband, for his heart to safely trust in the wife's decisions. Now, one of the things, obviously, that we have to do is be trustworthy people. And so one of the characteristics that should describe you as a wife is this attitude, this attribute of trustworthiness. And you who are single ladies here tonight, you should be known as a trustworthy person. In other words, it's more than the fact that your word is your bond. You're going to do what you say you're going to do, and you're not going to do what you say you're not going to do. But it also is that matters can be entrusted to you, and therefore the husband can know that the family is safe in your hands. But verse 11 goes on to say something else that's very interesting. It says, he will have no lack of gain. He will have no lack of gain. And one of the things that's interesting about this phrase is that it takes us into one of the big themes of this whole section, which is the subject of management. In other words, whether the woman is actually bringing in money through business or simply being a good steward and stretching every dollar, she brings gain so that he lacks nothing of value. She is a trustworthy manager of household affairs, and her husband gets gain either through her thrift or through her industry. Have you known some women in your time who could make do on very little? They could decorate with very little. They could actually prepare meals with very little. And through their thrift, they were able to get gain. That's a way of getting gain just as much as those who work or those who invest, as this woman does. But the point is, that it actually speaks in this verse of the husband getting material gain. Now, obviously, he gets other sorts of gain from being married to her. He gets the blessing of this trustworthy helper that is suitable to him. But this actually is talking about material gain because it's the Hebrew word for spoils. It's the Hebrew word for plunder. It's it's the word that means something of actual physical value. Okay. Does anybody have a comment just at this point before we go to verse 12? Then in verse 12, it says, she does him good and not evil all the days of her life. And this is what a husband ought to be able to say about his wife. There's something over in 1 Corinthians 7 that has been widely misunderstood by Christians. Let me just take you there for just a moment. 1 Corinthians 7. 1 Corinthians 7, verses 32 through 35. It's a paragraph that has many applications, particularly for single people. But it also has an application for married people as well. But I want you to be without care. He who is unmarried cares for the things of the Lord, how he may please the Lord. But he who is married cares about the things of the world, how he may please his wife. There is a difference between a wife and a virgin. The unmarried woman cares about the things of the Lord, that she may be holy both in body and in spirit. But she who is married cares about the things of the world, how she may please her husband. And this I say for your own profit, not that I may put a leash on you, but for what is proper, and that you may serve the Lord without distraction. What Paul is saying there is that when you are single, as a man or a woman, yes, you can in fact devote more time, energy, and effort to serving the Lord. And when you are married, the natural thing is that you will care about how to please your spouse. In other words, this is not a sarcastic statement, and it is not a statement implying that to be married is second rate, and it is not a statement that implies that being married is somehow sinful and you miss the Lord's best and so on. It's a statement that is simply saying that if you're married, that brings you into an obligatory situation where you must care about your spouse. He who is married cares about the things of the world, how he may please his wife, verse 33. And verse 34, she who is married cares about the things of the world, how she may please her husband. And there's no condemnation about that. And this is why I say to people who are missionaries or going to dangerous mission fields, that it is probably better that you remain unmarried, or if you are going to marry, marry someone of really like mind as yourself. Marry someone who really wants to be a missionary. Don't marry someone who just looks deep into your eyes, smiles shyly, and says, "You want to be a missionary? I do too." Marry somebody who really has a heart for missions as much as you do. Why? Because there's going to be a conflict between what you can do for the Lord as a single person and what you can do for the Lord as a married person. Let me just say to you that we had a situation a number of years ago where we quit supporting a missionary. His wife had left him, moved the children from the country in which he was serving back to the United States. And he wanted to keep on being a missionary. And we said, "We think that your duty as a Christian is to stop being a missionary for a while and to try to reconcile with your wife and to be as close to your children as possible and be a father to your children." Pretty radical advice, huh? Because God had called him to be a missionary. But he was also married and a father. And we felt that those things, according to this passage, took precedence over his ministry, that he was to minister to his wife and to his family. So, brothers and sisters, this is one of the things that is very important to remember. The person who gets married should be a person who fulfills this normal requirement. They desire to please their spouse, desire to please their wife, or please their husband. Now, of course, the two of you can certainly serve the Lord together, and all Christian married couples do in some way or another. But my point is simply this, that a husband should be able to say, she does me good and not harm. And of course, a wife should be able to say that about her husband too. Now let's go back to Proverbs 31 for just a moment. She does him good and not evil all the days of her life. For you who are single, this is what should be said about you in your relationships, even though you are not yet married. For you who are single, your friends, your parents, your co-workers should be able to say of you, she has done me good and not evil all the days of her life. And if the husband is an unbeliever, then there's an added dimension to this doing good. Naturally, those of you who are not married here tonight may not marry except in the Lord. So, you know, if you're getting too sweet on an unbeliever, just cut that off right now, because it'll do you no good. Or at least, you know, pray for that unbeliever's conversion, and after he's converted, let him come around again. But the point is that when you have a Christian wife who has become a Christian after being married to an unbeliever, and she's got a Christian husband, we're told an unbelieving husband, we're told that her whole demeanor of doing him good can be that which brings him to the Lord. Is that not true? 1 Peter 3. Yeah, let's look at that for just a moment. 1 Peter 3. This is a difficult situation, as many of you know. But it says in 1 Peter 3, 1, wives, likewise, be submissive to your own husbands, that even if some do not obey the word, they without a word may be won by the conduct of their wives. When they observe your chaste conduct accompanied by fear, do not let your adornment be, and New King James adds, merely in italics. I think they're right to do so. That isn't what the Greek says, but they've interpreted it that way, and I think it's right. Do not let your adornment be merely outward, arranging the hair, wearing gold, or putting on fine apparel. Again, that fine is in italics. Rather, let it be the hidden person of the heart, with the incorruptible beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God. For in this manner, in former times, the holy women who trusted in God also adorned themselves, being submissive to their own husbands, as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose daughters you are if you do good, and are not afraid with any terror. There's a lot packed in, of course, to verse 6. Just briefly, I'll say that it is talking about the wife submitting herself not only to the Lord, or not only to her husband, but to the Lord, and being a daughter of Abraham and doing what is good. That doing what is good means that she can't follow her husband into doing evil. It means that she has to obey God rather than men. But there may be some things that her husband wants from her that are not in and of themselves sinful. And if she will simply continue to do good and not be afraid with any terror, this is telling her that there is an opportunity here to win the husband without a word, simply by her own demeanor, by her spirit. So this is the kind of wife that is being talked about not only in 1 Peter, but back in Proverbs 31. Grady?
I just wanted to talk a little bit more about the last part of that verse. A very precious sister in the Lord shared with me that the Lord revealed to her the that the part about not being subject to any fear was what covered most sins of what a wife will commit in a marriage, because it's out of insecurity and all of those sort of problems that she'll nag or do whatever usurps the authority of her husband or
sure.
fear. All the undermining things all come out of fear. And that Sarah did not subject herself to fear is tactically a very important and crucial thing about her virtue. The fact that she was not subject to fear, but that she trusted in God, protected her from all those abuses and all those mistakes.
That's true. The fear here is that you're going to follow your husband's leadership and it's going to lead to disaster. And you've got to step in and correct it. And that's the fear. That's exactly right. Okay, on to verse 13 of Proverbs 31. Here we get down to the management and the activities and the industry of this woman. She seeks wool and flax and willingly works with her hands. This woman is out there making choices concerning materials, wool and flax. She makes choices concerning clothing, and she works with her hands to see that it is provided for her family. But then furthermore, down in verse 24, it says that she makes linen garments and sells them and supplies sashes for the merchants. So she sews and weaves in order to sell garments also. So here's the point. She not only provides for her family, but she has her own business concern. Furthermore, we'll read in a little while that she buys a field, and with her earnings she plants a vineyard and so on. And she perceives that her merchandise is good. And the question that we have to ask as we read this is this a contradiction of the ideal of a wife that we find in the New Testament? Because in the little epistle of Titus, in chapter 2, verses 3 through 5, it says, "The older women likewise, that they be reverent in behavior, not slanderers, not given to much wine." You old women, be careful about that. "Not given to much wine. Teachers of good things, that they admonish the young women to love their husbands, to love their children, to be discreet, chaste, homemakers, good, obedient to their own husbands, that the word of God may not be blasphemed." The old King James has keepers at home there. And that can sound like, you know, being kept at home. keeping yourself at home. But what Paul is talking about here is actually being busy at home, being a home worker, which is what the Greek says. But he doesn't say more than that. He doesn't say more than that here. In other words, this is a minimal requirement for a wife to be all these things, to love their husbands, love their children, discreet, chaste, homemakers. And so this is desirable that older women should teach younger women some homemaking skills. Most of you young women have had mothers to do this for you, but some don't. And this is an area where the ladies in the church should see to it that any one of you who doesn't know a great deal about making a home, who doesn't know a great deal about cooking, who doesn't know a great deal about domestic pursuits, should be able to learn these things. But the Proverbs woman that we're reading about tonight is busy at home. And Scripture is not contradicting itself here. Nothing in Scripture, either the Old Testament or the New Testament, would keep her from selling the garments and sashes or forbid her from buying a field and planting a vineyard with her earnings. So you can't make Titus 2:5 contradict what's going on here in Proverbs 31. The point is that her primary responsibility is to her family. And that is clear from the passage. Yes, brother.
I think Paul makes it pretty clear in Timothy what he was trying to say in Titus is that he says at the same time they also learn to be idle as they go around from house. bodies, talking about things not proper to mention. Therefore, I want younger widows to marry, bear children, keep house, and give the enemy no occasion for reproach.
Yeah.
They had a problem with widows and younger women that would not even keep in their own house, or even before they were even married, to go around from house to house. And Paul says there's men out there ready to reel them in. And that's how the Lord's name was blasphemed. Not that the woman was busy or working, but that she's idle and falling into sin.
That's right.
And then God's name was blasphemed.
That's right.
That is the opposite passage and the problem that Paul was indeed addressing. So you've got the Proverbs 31 woman with her primary responsibility to her family, and that is what's going on here. And then we need to say something else, and that is that there's no indication here in Proverbs 31 that the husband is not the primary provider. As a matter of fact, husbands are supposed to be the primary provider, according to 1 Timothy 5:8. Paul said, if any does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his own house, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. So, yes, the husband is to be the primary provider, but there are many, many provisions being made by this Proverbs 31 woman. The question of whether a wife should work outside the home is one in which many factors have to be weighed. And you have to ask, first of all, what's the desire of the husband in his role as leader? Will her working really be beneficial to the family, or does it aid her husband in his calling? Or will it do harm to the family? If it will not do harm to the family, will it do good for her? Because I think that, you know, the role of the husband is to help the wife be all she can be, all she was meant to be, as he mirrors Christ and the husband, and as he mirrors Christ and the wife mirrors the church. And so it may very well be that it is beneficial for some wives to work outside the home for various reasons known only to the husband and wife. Will it do good for her? Will it do good for others by providing a desirable product or a desirable service? Some Christians very much tend to overreact against the career woman who neglects her family. Now, we all want to react against the career woman who neglects her family. That's unscriptural. But we don't want to overreact against the career woman who neglects her family by taking another position. And this position is currently gaining ground in Christian circles. The position is this: that jobs and careers and even higher education are not for women. I don't know if you've gotten hints of this from various places, but I was appalled once when I was doing some premarital counseling. This was to a couple, not day springers, so don't guess. Anyway, I was doing some premarital counseling, and this young couple had been very much influenced by this mindset. They definitely had the right scriptural idea that the husband was to provide for the family and so on. But I happened to ask the young woman, I said, now, do you have any college education? And she did not. And I said, do you have a particular field that you've always been rather interested in that you might like to pursue someday? No. I said, now, your husband is obviously intending to provide for you, but we have to prepare for the fact that God sometimes takes people prematurely. And if your husband were to die, say in 5 years or 10 years, what would you do with yourself? What would you do with your life to support yourself? She said, well, I guess I would go back and live with my family. My jaw just about dropped. And her family, I'm sure, would have been very happy about this state of affairs, that she would have gone home. I'll tell you one thing, this Proverbs woman wouldn't have to go back to her family to be supported, you know, because after all, you know, your father may die, your mother may die, there may be nobody to go back to. We never know what's going to happen. And so the point is, young ladies should have skills. They should have marketable skills. They should have, I believe about everybody, as much education as they can possibly get. This Proverbs woman sows and weaves and plants and buys and sells, and she would be equipped to care for herself and for her children if her husband died. But this particular woman that I was talking to had no thought except simply to be cared for by somebody else for the rest of her life. Yes, brother.
What I saw here is kind of could be disturbing, but does she do what she wants to with her own money there?
The heart of her husband safely trusted.
Yeah, I see that, but I was just trying to tie it in with the Jewish people, you know, and how a woman could go out and buy land. Could she put it in her name? Or
yeah, that I do not know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because they had the Jubilee where it went back. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Her husband must trust her a whole lot, must really know her. I mean, you see that.
Yeah.
That is unbelievable for a Jewish, I think, for anybody besides that.
Yeah, it. I think that from what we know of the Mosaic Law, that the land would probably have to be in her husband's name. You know, there were exceptions only made for situations where there were no male heirs, no male people around at all. So, but the idea here is that she is given a great deal of freedom and a great deal of delegated authority by her husband. This husband does not micromanage her, does he? Okay? Let's look at verse 14. She is like the merchant ships. She brings her food from afar. All that is saying is that she is a resourceful supplier of food. She's one of these people who is very conscientious about coming up with meals, and she's compared to the merchant ships that sail in. It's like she brings food out of nowhere. Yes.
I think that also means that it's not just a make-do provision for her family. She actually brings in that which might be considered wonderful new recipes, exotic things that would take great effort and planning to be able to secure, that the ordinary woman just gets the potatoes out of the garden. You know, she does something extra for her family.
Yeah, you would get that impression. Verse 15, she also rises while it is yet night and provides food for her household and a portion for her maidservants. She's willing to start early, not only to feed her family, but to care for the maidservants, essentially to care for all who are under her care. So this is a woman who provides for the household, very much aware of their dependence on her. And of course, one of the things is that she has maidservants. But even with the maidservants doing their own chores and duties, she gives them the materials to work with. And so she is providing portions for the maidservants and all who she's obligated for.
This is the end of side one. Please turn the tape over now to continue listening.
She's a servant, too. Because she and her maidservants have switched roles.
Yes.
She's the one that's up cooking for the maids instead of vice versa.
Yeah, that's right. I'll try this exotic meal out on the maids first. Okay, anyway. Okay. Number 16. She buys a field, considers a field and buys it from her prophet. She plants a vineyard. Again, we don't know whose name the field is going to wind up in, but I would guess that it is the husband's because he has no lack of gain. He gains by being married to this wife. She's also seen to business interests outside her home for the benefit of her home. And she is a shrewd businesswoman who reinvests her profits. As I was reading about this wonderful woman, I happened to think of my own mother. And I happened to think of how all of the wise business decisions that my parents ever made were instigated by my mother. Every single one of them started out with an idea in her head, which she presented to my father. My father went for it, and I thought about the evolution of it all. I thought about the fact that it was her idea to build, own, and manage a motel, and they did that. And then when my father felt like it was too confining, she suggested that they sell the motel, put the profits into a house to live in, and buy a ranch. Then they put the profits into the house, lived in it, and got lease money from the ranch. Then she suggested that at the right time that they sell that ranch. They sold the ranch. She decided to give her half of the money to me so I could go to seminary. And eventually, after I went to seminary, we used some of the money to, you know, buy things, buy our duplex, and later on to make a down payment on our home. So, you know, I trace it all back to financial decisions that my mother suggested to my father. And, you know, here I am tonight in Austin, pastoring, essentially, because of all of these financial decisions that she made, like this Proverbs 31 woman. Charles Bridges has a great comment about this woman's diverse interests and industry. He says, "The standard of godliness here exhibited is not that of a religious recluse, shut up from active obligation under the pretense of greater sanctity and consecration to God. Here are none of those habits of monastic asceticism that are now extolled as the highest point of Christian perfection. One half, at least, of the picture of the virtuous woman is occupied with her personal and domestic industry. What a rebuke also does this convey to a self-indulgent inactivity." So here she is. She's out buying this field. She's taken some earnings, and she plants a vineyard and presumably gets money from it. And all the while, she is increasing the family wealth. Verse 17, you might take this literally. She girds herself with strength and strengthens her arms. So for those of you who do workouts and so on, you know, you can do that, but she does it through manual labor. Now, I tend to think that it's best to take 17 and 18 together and not think of the strength so much as literal physical strength as it is a strength of thought and purpose and resolve. Because it says in verse 18, she perceives that her merchandise is good. NIV interprets that a bit and says she perceives that her trading is profitable. But this is her merchandise that she has for sale, and her lamp does not go out by night. So what I'm taking this to mean is that verse 17 and 18 are probably teaching that, yes, maybe she does have strong arms, but I think that her diligence constitutes her strength. Her diligence in pursuing what is best for this family business is what is really her strength. And she stays up late to do it because it says that the lamp does not go out by night in verse 18. Verse 19, she stretches out her hand to the distaff, that is the rod of a spinning wheel, and she and her hand holds the spindle. And so here she is, a craftsman, personally making the threads on a spinning device or a spinning wheel. What you find here is a picture of not only industry, but creativity. And she uses all of her powers of creativity and craftsmanship that have been given her by God. I treasure so many things that Barbara has made for me over the years. She made a pillow that I still use in my study. She made it 19 years ago this year, and I have used it and cherished it. She has made me a couple of sweaters. One fit perfectly at the time. The other one had to wait for how I have become in the last few years for it to fit. But now, unfortunately, it fits perfectly. She gave me a wonderful cross-stitch picture of a church that is in my study, and I appreciate all of these personal things that have been given to me by her. I also appreciate cross-stitch and needlepoint that have been made for me by other people who have had affection or appreciation for me, and these two also hang in my study. Creativity and craftsmanship that have been given by God, and this woman uses those things. One of the things I would suggest to those of you who are single women is to pursue things that are artistic and to pursue things that you can make or that lead to adornment of perhaps your home or yourself. But extend your hands in that way. Then at verse 20, this is a compassionate woman. She extends her hand to the poor. Yes, she reaches out her hands to the needy. So she not only loves her family, but she can do what many people cannot do. There are many people who cannot go beyond love for their family. They're very concerned about their own family. There are those who have a tight little world of those in their own household, and they may feel kind of sorry and sort of compassionate for those not in their immediate family, but they don't really extend themselves beyond that. Christians are supposed to, and she can go beyond her family to care for the needs of others. Verse 21, she plans for the future. She's not afraid of snow for her household, for all her household is clothed with scarlet. Now, the Septuagint version translated that as clothed with a double garment. And that really might be the way it's supposed to be, because the term for a double garment is similar to the Hebrew word for scarlet. But in any event, the idea is of foresight and forethought for her family, that winter is coming, but she can rejoice because she's not afraid of bad weather. She has taken care of her family and made sure that they have what they need. Finally, verse 22. She makes tapestry for herself. She's doing something for herself. It's really okay. It's really all right to exercise her taste and her desires in the coverings that she makes. We don't know if the word is talking about tapestry here or if it's talking about coverings for her couches or her bed, but it is something that she makes for herself, for her pleasure. It's a gift that God has given her, and she uses that gift in the service of beauty and quality. In the service of beauty and quality. Furthermore, it says that her clothing is fine linen and purple. And you can well imagine that, you know, people would see her dressed in fine linen and purple, purple being a color associated with kings because of the scarcity of it, because it was very difficult to obtain the purple dye. This is why we know that Lydia must have been a rich one in the city of Philippi, because she was a seller of purple. But this woman's clothes are fine linen and purple. And there's no shame attached to this. There's no embarrassment inherent in the verse that this is something that, you know, she ought to be just giving away to the poor, or she should not be indulging herself in something so nice. Because one of the things that this passage is talking about is stewardship. That's a theme of this whole lesson tonight. And one of the things that you quickly learn about stewardship is that many times it pays to try to get and to own the best quality of something that you possibly can. And it's not something to be ashamed of, because that quality will last longer. And so when we first got married, I was the type of person that wanted to buy a cheap thing and then later on buy a nicer thing, and then later on, when we could afford it, buy the nicest thing. Barbara tended to think, no, buy the best we can afford now and we'll never have to buy another one. And so that's true. We have a number of things that we have owned for a quarter of a century, because we have gotten quality things and used them and been good stewards that way with the Lord's money. So let's not begrudge this rich lady for wearing fine linen and purple, because she is actually making a home and making herself beautiful with things of beauty and high quality. I'm going to end tonight by a couple of things. First, none of these activities in any way deny that the woman is feminine. They do not deny in any way that she is submissive to her husband. They do not imply in any way that she is the leader of the family. What they do show us is a woman using her gifts and her graces to the maximum of her ability. They show us a woman being all she can. And certainly, most of us men would look at this passage and say, boy, this is far more than I could ever do. And this is what is fascinating, is that you don't have a woman here who is in any way a shrinking violet, in any way a sort of passive personality. You have here a very capable woman. But there's no indication that her personality is one of being pushy. There's no indication that she is anything other than absolutely feminine. I think what you find in most women is an interesting combination of femininity and ability and industry that can equal and sometimes outdo what men can do or will do. Because getting back to my mother, I think of the fact that she loved flowers and she loved perfume and she loved nice dresses and she loved the color pink so much that she painted her hammer and her screwdriver pink. And she used those hammers and screwdrivers and pliers all the time at the house. She was, a very feminine woman. She was complimented as a lady of great dignity and beauty when she was all dressed up for the gubernatorial balls in the 1940s. And yet she was a true pioneer woman. And I could tell you things that I saw and heard of her doing that would make your stomach crawl, like pioneer women have to do occasionally. But the point is that this passage should not be perceived as tasks that cannot be done by somebody who is ultimately just as feminine as can be and being very ladylike and womanly. Let me read something to you from Dorothy Patterson. Dorothy Patterson is Paige's wife, for those of you who know who Paige Patterson is, head of the Southern Baptist Convention. And in a truly great book called Recovering Biblical Manhood and Womanhood, which is edited by John Piper and Wayne Grudem, there is an article by Dorothy Patterson, and this is what she says about Proverbs 31. She says, Proverbs 31 contains a full-length portrait of a godly heroine finished in minute detail. The passage is significant not only for what it includes, but also for what it omits. There's no mention of rights or pursuit of self-serving interests. Neither is the husband assigned to domestic pursuits. In fact, his occupation with other tasks is clearly stated. It says, this description of God's, and I love this, this description of God's bionic Wonder Woman is often labeled an alphabetic ode, the golden ABCs of the perfect wife, the portrait of the wife of many parts, a paradigm for brides-to-be. Perhaps its literary form is designed to make the passage easier to commit to memory. She's saying that because each line begins with a letter of the Hebrew alphabet. It's an acrostic, so it's designed for memorization. But it says, God's ideal woman is a committed homemaker, chaste helpmeet, upright, and God-fearing woman of strength. Though no woman can match skills and creativity perfectly with this model, all can identify their respective talents within the composite, and all can strive for the spiritual excellence of this woman of strength. This passage is recited in many Jewish homes on the eve of Sabbath, not only setting the high challenge for wife and mother, but also expressing gratitude for her awesome service to the household. At least half of the section is occupied with personal and domestic energy. The New Testament, too, is clear in its emphasis on a woman's needed and necessary energy and efficiency in managing her household. When Jesus reprimanded Martha, he did not condemn the vital housework she was doing. Neither did he decry the gracious hospitality extended to himself. Jesus did not say only one thing is needful, but pointed to the one thing Martha had omitted. He did admonish her not to be encumbered or burdened by her work to the exclusion of spiritual sustenance, which Mary had so faithfully sought. One is never to neglect spiritual preparation, not even for the joy of serving others. Now, for those ladies who have been listening to this tonight and saying, I can't be that woman and I'm a little resentful because I still have laundry to do when I get home tonight. Listen to this. The best way to make homemaking a joyous task is to offer it as unto the Lord. The only way to avoid the drudgery in such mundane tasks is to bathe the tasks with prayer and catch a vision of the divine challenge in making and nurturing a home. Brother Lawrence, a member of the barefoot Carmelite monks in Paris in the 1600s, set a worthy example. Lord of all pots and pans and things, he prayed, make me a saint by getting meals and washing up the plates. The time of business does not with me differ from the time of prayer, and in the noise and clatter of my kitchen, I possess God. Amen.
Thank you for listening to this tape.